And I'm Jacob Meyer.
And you're listening to the Tactical Tennis Podcast, episode number 2.
Today I'm calling in from Melbourne, and we were talking about the Australian Open.
So obviously the biggest news so far, I mean, there's been quite a few things happening down under, but the biggest news so far would be obviously Djokovic-Istomin. Big upset.
Djokovic is out in the second round for the first time in a decade.
Right, and not just that. I mean, lost at a Grand Slam to a player ranked outside the top 100.
Which, yes, Istomin's ranked, I think, 117 right now. But to be fair, Istomin has spent most of his career ranked inside the top 100.
Yeah, fair enough. So you actually, one of the players that you were working with, just recently had a practice session with Djokovic. Isn't that right?
Yeah, we did. We actually got called up because he's a lefty. Not Novak, that's my guy, and they wanted a lefty to warm up with a couple hours before Novak's first round, which was against Fernando Verdasco,
who is a lefty. So,
yeah.
Right,
it was
and
big hitting lefty.
Right, so we're going to talk about that practice session and what Djokovic looked like, but really quickly, because probably most people don't get the chance to kind of experience this stuff. So the practice courts, tell us what the practice courts are like at the Australian Open for the players.
Well, it's pretty busy, especially in the first couple of rounds. You've still got a lot of people left over from the last round of qualies. All the doubles guys are there. All the doubles girls are there. All the guys and all the girls are there. So they've got something like 30 courts, but that has to fit in everyone's practice, everyone's training, and warm up for all the matches for the day. So there's a couple of show courts, where they have basically the big boys, as we call them in practice, mm-hmm. Your Novaks, your Federers, you know, the super popular guys, like Gael Monfils was out there. He draws a pretty good crowd. Anyone that is sort of, you know, a marquee name that, let's say, the casual tennis fan that, you know, goes to just the US Open or just the Australian Open and maybe doesn't play that much would be familiar with.
Sure. So
and those courts are pretty nice. I mean, yeah. They could be. Yeah, I mean, they're basically, you know, they're set up for viewing, mm-hmm. And for TV cameras and, you know, for social media and doing all that kind of stuff. So they're pretty cool.
Right. And there's kind of, at least on some of the practice courts, you mentioned there was a kind of a boundary in place.
Yeah, on one of the courts in particular, we were supposed to warm up on court 17, I think, for those of you that are actually in Melbourne this year or going there in the future. And the backside of one of the courts is plexiglass, I suppose. I mean, it's mm-hmm. definitely, or it might just be glass, but I mean, it's clear viewing glass, which is a little weird for the players because we're not used to playing in a glass enclosure like a, you know, squash professional might be. But it's really cool for the fans because you can just crowd into the court. You know, they stack them probably 5 or 10 people deep, and you can still get a pretty good view, and you're just a couple of feet from the best guys in the world. You can really get a feel for the speed of the ball.
Right. So that's a much more intimate viewing environment besides the, you know, glass barricade.
Yeah. And then, I mean, the guys are literally hanging on the fence. there's just a little bit of space between, say, the court on the inside and where people are on the fence, but generally in Australia people are pretty respectful, which makes it easier to get closer.
Sure. So you're supposed to practice on practice court number 17, but you don't actually practice there. So tell us about why that happened. What changed?
Yeah. It's not like we're tight with Novak. The practice got set up through the tournament. He I guess specifically asked for us, I think, because of the way that my guy serves. He can pretty much replicate the Verdasco serve. But we were sitting out on court 17, you know, trying to be respectful. We warmed up 30 minutes before our warm up just so that we didn't mess with his preparation. You know, the players all have a lot of respect for the top guys and for each other generally. And then we headed out for our appointed time. I think it was at 4:30 for, you know, what was supposed to be was supposed to be a full session with Novak, and proceeded to spend the next 15 minutes sitting on the court waiting around. Eventually, we got the call that Rafa had steamrolled through his match, and Rod Laver Arena was open, and so Novak wanted to move the practice over to Rod Laver Arena. It's just that nobody was able to actually tell us
Right, so you guys end up switching over Rod
while
Laver,
we
and
were
then
waiting around.
right, because he obviously wants to practice on the court that he's going to play his match on. So how did Novak look in that practice? I mean, was there early signs of trouble?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think that you can say that there was. I mean, certainly physically, he looked really sharp. He was very focused. He's intense. He seemed to be going through all his normal routines. I mean, he's a very friendly guy. Like, he's very polite and nice to everyone. All the normal sort of stuff. He practiced, specific patterns, the same kind of stuff that he, essentially practices in all of his public. Well, I mean, it's not like he has the same practice all the time, but the same kind of practice that he would have in all of his public practices that we have access to, where, he's serving out wide and practicing the first ball, spreading it out, to the opposite corner. Occasionally he's practicing going behind, on that first ball. He was really getting a feel for the court. We talked about how the court changed a little bit from last year. It seems to be playing a little bit quicker, which happens. It was a hot day, so that affects it, of course.
Sure.
But, besides being maybe a little bit more on edge than you would expect for a first round match,
Well, I mean, his first round was
he
Verdasco. I
seemed
mean,
perfectly normal.
who's not going to be nervy about playing Verdasco on the first round of a slam? So I think that's
Yeah, I mean,
perfectly
truth be
natural.
told, like, I thought, okay, he's a little bit easily perturbed right now, as in he really wants to make sure that he's hitting everything exactly perfectly. But one, this guy has been number one for ages until Andy just took it from him. And two, he knows who he's playing. I mean, Verdasco can beat anybody, and nobody wants to play Fernando in the first round. So
Yeah.
it seems like his preparation was absolutely spot
Okay.
on. He was hitting the ball clean. There really wasn't anything to point to, what happened against Isman.
Sure. So he goes out and he plays, I think, a solid match against Verdasco. I mean, not something we wouldn't call that his best tennis, but certainly not his worst either. Handles Verdasco comfortably. And certainly, I think there's no signs of trouble when we look at the match with Verdasco. Just looks like an early year, early round match from a Grand Slam. He goes out, takes care of business. Obviously, maybe not quite in his best rhythm at his peak yet. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I don't know how much of the match you got to see, or I think we always see slightly different things, but the only thing that stood out to me against the Verdasco match in the Verdasco match was that he was lights out returning earlier on, and he won the first five games and went out to a 5-0 lead, right? He had chances to win that first set 6-0, and he was just all over the return. He returned very well against us. I mean, we served pretty tough at him. And it just seemed to me that as he had some chances to really kind of lay the hammer down, he didn't quite seem as sharp in between the ears as what he would have, say, a year ago. But that's it. I mean, I don't, that can be explained in so many different ways that we really didn't make much of it. We just thought, oh, okay, first round, or it's Fernando,
Sure,
or,
sure. So then let's move to Istomin, and obviously huge upset there. I feel like I don't think Djokovic played a bad match. I don't think obviously it was his best tennis. I think if Djokovic came out and played his absolute best tennis, I mean, Istomin just simply is not capable of hanging at that level. And I mean, granted, we have
Yeah,
to give Istomin
agreed.
credit for playing, the match of his life. I mean, that's the best tennis I think we've seen from him, certainly in a televised match. Maybe he's played better in some small tournament against a lesser opponent, and we just never knew about it. But that was obviously a peak performance from him. I think maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Istomin played pretty well. Like, I honestly don't know if he's ever hit the ball any better than that. And I think he was striking it clean. Like, he's known to have a pretty good backhand, but I mean, he was just hitting winners.
Right.
And it's not easy to hit a winner on Novak.
No, it is not. It is not. And, you know, certainly watching, I didn't see any signs of movement issues with Djokovic. You know, and we've seen Djokovic come out and play badly. I mean, it has happened. We haven't seen a lot of it, especially in the last couple of years. But, you know, we have seen him come out and have matches where he misses a lot and he's very temperamental. But he didn't come out at the start of this match just missing. It wasn't like he came out having a terrible day. I mean, I think Istomin, by and large, just outplayed him, and Djokovic failed to raise his level high enough necessary to beat him.
Yeah, and that's the thing that really stood out to me, was that normally, like, when we see Novak play what we would call a bad match or think of as like a really poor performance on his part, it's really bad. Like,
yeah,
he's missing the first ball, he's missing the second ball,
right, easy
shots.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
I do. Like, it's, and that's always struck me about him, is he's either like an absolute machine where he goes out and misses nothing, or just every once in a while he'll come out and have a match where, I mean, he just looks nothing like the Djokovic that we're used to these days. But it just, this wasn't one of those matches. So
no, like, he's making 4, 5, 6 balls in the rally and just not playing quite up to his standard.
Right.
And then Istomin is saying, hey, like, this guy hasn't hit a winner on me in the first 5 balls. I'm going to crack a ball down the line and making it.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, you know, also Istomin, I think, did a great job of extending rallies. I mean, his defense was impressive. I really was impressed, not to reuse the same word over and over again, but I mean, I was really impressed with his lateral movement and his ability to defend and extend rallies with Djokovic when I saw Djokovic taking control of points, you know. And there was multiple times in that match where he would get that extra ball in play and make Djokovic come into the net to finish and then pass him. And we know Djokovic's short court game, you know, his approach shot is great, like his put away ball is great, but let's be honest, Djokovic's volleys and his overhead, not the best.
Yeah, two things there. One, I did notice that I think Istomin moved exceptionally well for him. He's not known as a good mover. And, I mean, he was, like, sliding into open stance balls like his last name is Djokovic.
Right.
Which was pretty surprising to me.
In a sense.
Yeah. And then, you know, Novak at the net. I mean, his forehand volley is not bad, and his drop shots are pretty good, but, like, he's got pretty obvious holes in the overhead and in the backhand volley.
The infamous Djokovic smash.
Yeah. It just, you know, but Istomin, I mean, just hit winners on him. It wasn't even like Novak, like, made a bunch of errors at
no,
the net.
No, actually, I think Novak volleyed reasonably tidily. But, you know, it just comes down to that, you know, and I've talked about this before, where I think Novak's game is very much built for that higher ball, that shoulder-high ball on both sides. And I saw a lot where Istomin was on the run, very defensive in the point, behind in the point, played the ball short but kept it on the lower side. And I think Djokovic really struggles to put that ball away in the way that Federer and Nadal do. Just, you know, that very specific shot. And so, again, just extended that rally with that one extra ball, those two extra balls, and then took advantage. I mean, and let's be honest, like, he didn't make every pass, but geez, he made enough of them.
Do you think there's a way in which Istomin actually, like, how much of this match do you think is explained by how Istomin played the match specifically versus how Novak didn't live up to his usual standard?
I think there's a mixture of both. I believe that Istomin didn't allow Djokovic to play in a way that lets him play his best tennis, you know? He did one thing that I saw Federer doing at Wimbledon a few years ago that I really liked, in that you see him move the ball around a little bit, where he's not going multiple times, you know, like 5, 6, 7 balls cross court. He would change it up, right? But not in a way where he exposed himself. So he's changing direction moderate amounts from the center of the court. And I always feel like if you give Djokovic, you know, like Federer's made this mistake in the past where he hits a forehand and he gets a forehand back and he goes wider and wider. And once you open the court up enough for Djokovic and he'll just punish you, whereas when Fed, you know, like moves Djokovic side to side but not too wide that he opens the court up and exposes his own movement, then, you know, I think Djokovic actually can give some stuff up. And I saw Istomin doing a little bit of that pattern. And I think defensively he did a good job of not giving Djokovic the balls that he likes to have to put away and end the point. And I don't think Djokovic likes to finish at the net. He likes to finish with the forehand in, you know, kind of service line area, maybe slightly behind with a ball that's kind of shoulder high. Istomin didn't give him a lot of that. And so I think, well, he really didn't let – and there was a lot of depth too. The other thing that stood out to me was Istomin played good depth during the rallies and really pushed Djokovic back, but pushed him back center where, again, no angle. Didn't let him kind of give him anything to open the court up with.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, Istomin did handle the just sheer velocity of Novak's ball, and he handled Novak's depth really well. Because Novak – I mean, if you haven't – looked really closely at it, Novak hits the ball flat and deep probably more than anybody else. Well, when you combine it with his consistency.
Sure.
And I mean, he's doing that just on a rally ball, not on a putaway ball. Like, he is, like, I can't tell you within 6 inches of baseline just in, you know, a 1 hour practice. Like,
right,
it's
just
outrageous.
Over and over again, right?
Oh, it's just absolutely automatic. And, you know, you mentioned him finishing at the net. Like, he's fully capable of finishing at the net, but he likes to do it after he's gotten you on the run and off the court. He doesn't like
I think we're having
like
a
to
little,
finish on the net, you know,
little bit
say
of internet,
in a neutral hole where, like,
hiccup there. You still there, Jake?
Oh, well, that's too bad.
Yeah,
you got me back yet.
Yeah, no, I got you back now. I think we just, you know, Skyping from Australia. Lost you there for a second. So you were saying it's not that he doesn't like to finish it. He just likes to finish at the net under very specific circumstances. I think in, you know, there's a very specific way he wants to have that volley. I think Istomin did a good job of keeping him out of those patterns.
He basically wants the volley to just be a finishing volley.
Right. Fair enough. Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about Kyrgios, who lost in the second round of Seppi, or third round, was it? But either way, after, you know, an interesting, you know, you and I talked about this a few days ago, that I mean, it seemed like there was a shift in Kyrgios' attitude leading into this tournament in a good way. Right? I mean, we've seen kind of the tanking,
yeah,
Kyrgios,
definitely.
The guy who goes out and just throws matches. And then this was something a little bit different. You know, he talked about, you know, like his attitude in his pre-match tournament interviews was different. Right?
Yeah, I thought it was really good.
So,
yeah,
I think so. There was something you said to me about it. Beforehand, of just kind of some of his wording. Nope, oh, I think we've lost you again.
I think we're still having difficulties.
Oh,
over
there
here.
We go. You're back. Yeah, so it's just kind of his the way he was talking about the tournament, the way he was talking about his game was a little bit different. Seemed to be a little more positive.
His whole philosophy, I mean, I hesitate to call it that just because I don't think it's, like, you know, something that he sat down and put together.
That sounds a little too organized.
But,
yeah, sure.
Right. It's not that organized. But the outlook, the tone, you know, what he was even trying to express, it really seemed like he hadn't either been coached in his communication or improved, just, you know, really improved it and been more thoughtful about things.
Right.
And, you know, I still hold that he's a good guy, that he's a thoughtful kid, and, you know, that he struggles through things just like the rest of us,
right,
and that
he's
trying to do a good job.
One thing that people lose sight of is the fact that, like, here in America, for example, most kids his age are at college, going to parties, you know, getting drunk and dating and you know, doing typical teenage, late teenage, early 20s things. And that's not him at all. Like, he's this kid who's in the international spotlight. You know, he's every little mistake that he makes gets plastered all over the national news and international news. I mean, he's under a lot of scrutiny, a lot of pressure, and I think he's just making typical young adult mistakes, and they happen to get blown up. And I think sometimes we lose sight of the fact that, I mean, Federer's behavior, while obviously very different from Kyrgios's, but still, he was no angel when he was 19 and 20. Like, he was petulant out on the court. He would throw some tantrums and break rackets, and, you know, he had an epiphany moment. You know, I think we've been a little bit spoiled with guys like Rafa, who, you know, Rafa has been in the spotlight since he was 17, 16, 15. God, who, I couldn't even tell you exactly when all that started. But point being that he's handled himself. He's handled himself with such class every step of the way. And a lot of that probably has to do with his background. I mean, he has such strong family ties. And, you know, obviously traveling with his uncle, who he has so much respect for, and who also has been there to really, truly guide him every step of the way. And he's had that family unit, that support unit around him that I just don't sense Kyrgios has had. And so when we see guys like Rafa, you think, well, that's how it should be done. And sure, that's how it should be done. But how many of us did everything the way that it should be done when we were 19 years old? And, you know, that's a very, very short list. So, I mean, let's keep that in perspective.
Even more than that.
Right.
I mean, you've got to consider, like, Rafa probably did a better job of these things than not just you or me, but anybody else.
Oh, right. He did a fantastic job, you know, and it's just having somebody do such a good job that ended up becoming such an icon in the game. And, you know, again, we didn't see Federer at 17. He didn't have the spotlight. When he got the spotlight, he was the Federer we see now, who's so cool, calm, and composed, and such a great ambassador for the sport. But that's, you know, not the way that he always handled things. But so coming back to the actual topic here, I mean, so curious, we saw a little shift. I mean, I don't think that it's him being coached, you know, in terms of his communication, obviously because he didn't have a coach for the tournament, but I don't think that it's him being coached in terms of his communication. I think there was an actual genuine shift. I mean, this is a kid who struggles with himself a lot, and it seemed for the first time that we heard him talking a little bit about tennis in a different way, in a more positive light. And so he goes out there and wins, obviously, his first round, and he comes up against Seppi, who, let's be real, Seppi is a tough player. Seppi is no pushover, right? I mean, I think he's on that shorter list of players you don't want to play early in Grand Slams.
At some point.
Well, sorry, say again.
It's fun talking over each other from halfway across the world.
Yes.
Seppi has beaten just about everyone
at some point. Right.
In his career.
Yes, he has.
I mean, he's beat Fed in majors. He's like, I mean, he's just, if you're not on your game, you don't want to play Seppi.
Right. Even if you
are
on
your game.
If
you're firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, if you're one of the absolute top players, if you're one of the elite level players and you're firing on all cylinders, sure, you feel comfortable about a Seppi. But
exactly.
If you're not one of the absolute top guys, I mean, I just don't think you do feel comfortable playing Seppi ever. But even if you are one of the top guys, if you're a little off, like, he's a very tough opponent. But so we get out there to the match, and Kyrgios, you know, obviously starts out very strongly, wins the first two sets, and then kind of the wheels fall off a bit.
Yeah, I think the wheels fell completely off.
Well, not completely off, because the serving wheel stayed on. I mean, that was rolling along pretty well for the whole match, by and large.
I was literally working with another player while we were watching this match, and in the middle of, just out of the blue, he turns to me and says, you know, Nick's serve is so good that he hasn't made a ground stroke, it feels like, in like three or four games, and he's still holding serve.
Right. And I mean, he is that good of a server. I mean, his serving is, especially for his height, I mean, it's phenomenal. But yeah, I mean, obviously you can't.
It's outrageous.
Yeah, it is an outrageously good serve, but you can't not make ground strokes for a set and a half.
You can't, but I think the wheels, to me watching it, the wheels totally fell off because I think there were a couple of games where he was like, ah, whatever, you know, I'm making some errors, and he had, you know, maybe some of the immaturity shows, and he didn't put everything that he had into, you know, getting back on track.
Right, and some of that could have been energy
at
management.
At a certain point.
Right, I mean, well, let's hang on one second there, because, I mean, he talked after the match about not coming to the tournament with the level of conditioning, not having done the work in off season. So, you know, having breezed through the first two sets, there could be a level of, well, I'm behind a break in this set, I'm just going to let this one ride out, and, you know, the serve doesn't cost him a lot of energy, so he's going to serve hard, and just, you know, if he gets a lucky break, he gets a lucky break, but if he doesn't, he's just, you know, he's saving energy for the next set. And then again, saving energy for the next set. Because, you know, obviously in the fifth set, I mean, a 10-8, nobody gives up. Nobody tanks a fifth set and loses at 10-8. I mean, he obviously fought.
Yeah, I mean, that's that's like three sets of tennis.
Right, so he fought through that.
Yeah, he's fighting through it. What was shocking was that in the fourth set, he was just terrible. And he was really trying hard.
Right.
And to me, those tough situations where the pressure for him is massive there. And, you know, we should take a tangent here. Like, I'm in the U.S. most of the year, or when I'm not traveling. I mean, I'm based in the U.S., right? Mm-hmm. And I had no idea until I actually came over to the Australian Open for the first time how big media was for these tennis players in Australia.
Right.
It's like India and Australia. These guys are literally plastered all over every channel on television.
Sure.
I mean, it's like we don't get anything like that in the U.S. There's nothing like it. Like, I don't see Tom Brady's face as much as I see Nick Kyrgios's face
right
when I'm in Australia in the summer leading up to the Australian Open. It is insane. So when he's in the second round or the third round of a slam and he hits a road bump and realizes, oh my God, I am really struggling and I might lose now. I mean, it's like, you know what you're going to get in the media is it's got to be on your mind. And it just doubles, triples, quadruples the pressure that's going on there. And so when you come back to the match, on this backdrop of I'm going to catch so much slack from the whole world, not just from the tennis media that we see in the U.S. I mean, I think it just shows his training, not his conditioning in the off season in 2016, 2017, but just the fact that he's still very young and he still doesn't know, like he doesn't understand his own patterns. He doesn't know what his best plays are. You know, he
right.
just
that's
hasn't
not having
done
the right coach
work to be a complete player.
Right.
Yeah, he doesn't have
he
a coach
he
at all
have,
right
he
now.
He doesn't have a fallback. And I mean, his fallback basically is I'm going to serve very well, which is not the same thing as, you know, like your Djokovic's and your Federer's and the Nadal's, who have so many patterns to fall back on. They have so much structure to their game that, you know, if plan A isn't working, they don't just have a plan B or a plan C. They have like a plan F. And, you know, they have multiple ways to fall back on when they're not playing well. And for Kyrgios, like, he doesn't even really have a plan A. I mean, plan A is I'm going to serve really well, and I'm going to hit big forehands. That's plan A. And plan B is...
I don't
is,
even know if he has a plan.
Well, I think he does have a plan. I think he has a plan, but I think his plan is very, very rudimentary, and it basically the plan is I'm going to hit big serves and big forehands. And, I mean, sure, it's not much of a plan, but it's a plan.
I mean, yeah, I think that's being awfully generous. Like,
okay.
He worked with good coaches when he was young. He worked really hard when he was young. But I think anything that we would properly consider a strategy has gone out the window in the last 18 months.
Right.
He's
well,
just
I mean,
going
he's
out
been,
there
yeah.
and just doing whatever he feels like.
Doing.
And just playing.
But I think this is, brings us back really to, I think, the most important part, which to me isn't the loss, you know? I mean, it's not like I expected Kyrgios to win the Australian Open. And honestly, at this point in his career, making, you know, the round of 16 versus losing in the round of 64, does it really matter that much? I don't think so. But what really stood out to me was his post-match interview, which had a very different tone. And it was, obviously I need a coach. I didn't do the work over the off season that I should have. It just was different. You know, this was again coming back to the comments and the tone that we saw before the tournament started. This is a slightly different. This is a little bit. It's a more mature Nick Kyrgios, guy who realizes.
I think it is.
This is the guy who realizes it, who doesn't have really had a plan. Okay, I'll admit I was being entirely too generous. The guy who hasn't had a plan, and he stands up on the public stage after losing in a very public manner. And a very difficult circumstance. I mean, it's heartbreaking to lose 10-8 in the fifth set of your home slam and to walk into the press conference and say, basically, hey, I haven't had a plan and I need to have a plan. That's a very mature thing for him to do. Makes me feel very optimistic.
Yeah, and... I mean, I am. I mean, the kid's talent level is
through the roof. I mean,
out of this world.
Yeah, as long
I
as
don't
he
know
can
that we've seen anything like it.
Manage if he can manage
and
his body and not, you know, and get. Obviously, I think he'll get there. I think he's gonna win slams. I think he's gonna, you know, end up in the top three in the world. It's just a matter of if he takes care of his body and you know, eventually gets the right setup. I think for him, it's all about that support structure. It's all about having the right people around him to keep, you know, things on track.
Yeah, to help him actually do the work.
Yeah.
Because it's not so obvious what the work is. You know, I mean, the guys are getting smarter and smarter. The only thing I want to point out about that press conference is that it would have been really easy for Nick to just make excuses and kind of continue along the same lines that he was doing a year ago.
Apathy.
Yeah, and well, or just be dismissive or say, you know, I don't really like this, or to say something inflammatory or whatever. I mean, there's 100 things he could have done that would have been kind of crappy, would have kept him in the headlines. They really wouldn't have hurt his career, you know, long term.
No, it would have just fulfilled the expectations, these preconceived notions that everybody already has about him anyway.
Exactly. And standing up and just saying, you know, hey, like, I didn't do good enough. I think I could have done better, and, like, I probably need some help. That seems obvious now. I mean, like, if he was my kid or my brother or, you know, my best friend, like, that's pretty much what I would want him to do.
Right.
So I think you just got to say, like, good on you, and hopefully you can get some really good people around
that's
you.
It's supposed to be good on you, mate. Just FYI.
Good on you, mate.
Yeah.
Well,
so
yeah,
actually, speaking of having done the work.
You have to apologize for me blending the Australian.
Yeah. Speaking of having done the work, just to wrap up, let's touch base really quickly on a name people might not expect to hear, which is Ivo Karlovic and the kind of shape that monster is in.
So the guys at the tournament are talking about this because John Isner almost went into a super long match early in the tournament. He ended up losing. Even if he wins that match, the idea is that it takes such a toll
on him, right,
that it ruins his tournament, and he probably loses the next match.
Right. We've seen that from Isner before several times.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pattern in his career. And John's in the best shape of his life. Side note, Karlovic plays almost a 5.5-hour match. He was sick for the first set and a half of it. Wasn't feeling himself.
Right.
Still hit 75 aces.
Yeah.
Like, who was 75 aces? I mean, if it wasn't for the Isner-Mahut match, you know, this is a record.
Right.
And the guys are taking notice. Wait a minute. Ivo is 38 years old.
Yep.
He's in the best shape of his life. This guy walks around the locker room and he's like physically bigger and stronger, not just taller, but like bigger. Like the guy has muscles.
Right.
He's in the gym every day and people are thinking, whoa, like he's really taking care of himself. He comes back in the next round and it's boom, 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 4-4-4.
Straight sets.
He's done.
Out
he's
the door.
Moving on. And all of a sudden we're looking at Ivo like, well, he's probably going to the fourth round. And you know, why is this so different from John? And then we start to ask more questions like, man, he was 38 years old. He was not the most athletic guy. He's still not the most athletic guy. I mean, if he's doing it, what does this mean for everybody else?
Right. Well, I mean, but I think also there's that element where, I mean, just the style of play, the sheer number of serves he hits that don't come back. I mean, that man has run, at 38, he's spent a lot less time, he's covered a lot less miles on the court than, you know, I mean, he covers a lot less miles per match than a Djokovic or a Nadal or virtually anybody else. You know, so, I mean, there is that.
Yeah, that's fair. The flip side of that is that, you know, we would have said like 2 or 3 years ago that Novak was in 1,000 times better shape than Evo.
Right, we can't say that anymore.
And he's, what, 10 years younger?
Right, you know? Sure.
So, you know, yeah, like he's more efficient in a way. I don't know if efficiency can account for that much. Like Federer's efficient, but he's 35, and
right.
It was just like 2 hours ago that he absolutely laid the hammer down on Berdych, where, you know, Berdych's probably playing the best tennis of his life, and the gap between, you know, his game and Federer's game might be growing.
Well, yeah, like, which is interesting because let's be real, like that gap had shrunk a couple of years ago, and here it is growing. Yep. You know, I mean, Berdych has had some very, very notable wins over Federer in the last 5 years, and this result was, I think, in some ways a statement. But that's probably a topic for another podcast episode. So Karlovic in amazing shape, has Goffin next. Do we feel like he's going to get through that one?
You know, the word on the street, if we want to call it that here, but the feeling seems to be like people seem to feel like Evo is going to get through,
right.
Even though generally Goffin is a good matchup. He's a great returner. You know, he should win every ground stroke rally, but Goffin almost went out to Riley Opelka, who's like the 19-year-old American version of Ivo Karlovic with better ground strokes.
Right.
And ended up winning in the fifth set against him. But Ivo is, you know, Riley's a great guy, like a really, really good human being. But, you know, Ivo's a lot more mature. You know, he's been around the game a lot longer.
Sure.
His decision making in the big moments is much better. And I don't think even Riley would argue that.
Right. And I mean, at this point, like Ivo's, I mean, you know, tennis has been good to Ivo. The pressure's not there. I mean, he's just there because he wants to be there. And he's, you know, he's done the work and he's had the experience. I mean, this is a great moment for him. Absolutely. I mean, there's no other reason for Ivo Karlovic to be playing tennis other than the fact that he just loves it. You know,
and especially the fact that he's top 20 in the world.
Well, sure. But I mean, point being, I mean, he's made money. And at this point in his life, I mean, heck, he could go out there and stay top 50 without doing all this hard work just on his serve alone. And yet here he is actually doing the extra work to be in the sort of shape that he's in. I think there's going to be some big results for him this year if he keeps this up and stays healthy. So good chance of taking Goffin out, and then, you know, from there, who knows? Well, I think we'll wrap up there and pick up in a couple of days back in Melbourne, and hopefully there's some great tennis for us to talk about in the interim.
I'm sure there will be.
All right. Later, everybody.
See ya.